Jay has to sign.
You're on.
We'll make him sign.
Okay,
you're on. Under duress.
I'll be 8 months shy of 20 years public service.
Okay. Can I, please open this meeting today. I am very pleased to see so many of you here, some of my friends that I haven't seen since May's last meeting at the county center, which was...
Since cold weather? No.
They came out, that day was cold. That day, they were there, and it was a big turnout, and it was great, and I thank everybody. And now it's time to start again. We have first to approve the minutes of 1:26.
So moved.
Second, if I was here.
Right. And
you are.
Today, we have two speakers, okay? There's really a lot to speak about on this committee, a lot to do on this committee, okay? Like it or not like it, I'm not asking. We had the health care bill passed, okay? And we should all take a wait and see attitude, hope that it works and work with it to see that everything is okay. We had to have something. You can't just say no to anything. And whatever has to be fixed, we'll make sure there are amendments, there are things that have to be fixed and all that. We got to give it a chance, okay? And I'm tired of listening to political rhetoric of the bad things and the good things. It's here. We're going to work with it, and that's it. But this committee is going to know everything that's going on. We're going to have speakers between May's office, between the state, between the federal government, what is going to, how seniors are going to be affected, what we can do to help. And I certainly give it my best wishes and hope, because whatever is good for this country is good for everybody in it, okay? We have a lot of problems, and we're going to work on them. But today, we have Annette Alvey, Westchester County Office for Women, and Anna Massapus, Westchester County Office for the Disabled. They're going to present the results of a domestic violence survey. This survey was a collaborative initiative between the Westchester County Office for the Disabled and the Office for Women, reaching out to women and men with disabilities who are victims of domestic violence. And after that, we really have a very, very nice treat. We have the Top Chef Meals. And I'd like to start it with Annette.
Thank you.
Okay, Annette, and with Annette is Anna. Okay. The floor is yours. Okay, we have like a half hour for each, you know, presenter. So I want to begin, okay?
Okay, thank you. We decided to do the survey because as far as domestic violence and disabled, think about that issue as where domestic violence itself was about 30 years ago. It's just now bubbling up where people are realizing we need to start talking about it and educating ourselves about it. And as the Office for Women started researching it, as you know, with statistics, I was finding there weren't a lot of studies, but some said as much as 85% of disabled women have suffered abuse, some say about half. And so, you know, we discussed it and we thought, let's do an incident survey in Westchester County. So that's how it came about. And it was just natural for us to reach out to work with the Office for Disabled because their experience there were experienced with domestic violence. Statistically, in Westchester, based on a 2000 survey, there are about 140,000 disabled people in Westchester over the age of 16. 74,000 of those are women. And when we talk about disabilities, we're talking about physical, sensory, and mental disabilities. Before we get into the results of the survey, and I have given, you all have like a summary of that survey that you can take home with you, but just, I wanted to frame the problem a little bit, is that domestic violence is complex, but domestic violence in disabled people is incredibly complex. And I think because of that complexity, a lot of times we sort of shy away from working with it because it almost, I've been in meetings where I feel so overwhelmed. It's like you just go, it's too big to deal with. But what we're doing is we're starting. And I think that Anna, because she has experience working with people with disabilities, can give you a sense of the complexity of the issue. And I think I got you right while you're...
I think that when we think about people with disabilities, it's sometimes hard to imagine or fathom that somebody would hurt someone who is physically disabled or developmentally disabled, but it does happen all the time. And some of the things that you might not think of that are abuse, it's not always, as you frequently look at disabled women that have been beaten up and they're taken to the hospital and stuff, there's more subtle ways that people with disabilities can be abused, such as if a woman uses a wheelchair, frequently it is her intimate partner or husband, they will keep the wheelchair away from them and not allow them to get up and get around. They can withhold medications. They can keep their assistive devices away from them, whether it's a telephone that is adapted to so that they can't make telephone calls, or again, their wheelchair, their walker, their canes, things that they just really can't live without. Women who are blind frequently report that they'll move the furniture around, which is a horrible, horrible thing. Or they'll mistreat their service animal or keep the service animal from them. And if you're blind and that's what you use is a dog to guide you, if you don't have your dog right there with you, you're lost. And I think that frequently, as Annette said, we did this survey, but I don't think that half of the people who are disabled, the women that are disabled and abused, report it because they're afraid that if they speak up, then what's going to happen to me? Frequently, the abuser will threaten to, put them in a nursing home, put them somewhere where, you need to go somewhere where they can take care of you. This is not my job to help you. I'm going to use an example that is actually, it's a real story, and it happens to be a family member of mine that I didn't realize until recently had been suffering. And when I said, oh my God, you're being abused, she was like, oh no, I'm not. He doesn't hit me. But some of the things that she, was able to finally tell me that her husband was doing to her was she has MS and uses a wheelchair. Up until about a year or so ago, she could do most of her transferring by herself. She actually could limitedly use a walker. And then she had some other ailments, and she really deteriorated quite quickly. So that she needed assistance in the bathroom. Although most of the time she could transfer herself and get onto a toilet by herself, she didn't have the strength or ability, she just felt it was so degrading, to be able to pull her pants back up. And she needed assistance with that because, you can't do that just sitting down. You have to be able to lift your body up and stuff. And when she called for her husband to help her, he did it begrudgingly, but he would just like yank her underwear and her pants up so that it went all up into her body, and then she wasn't able to pull it out. There were times recently when she could not transfer herself, and he's a pretty big guy. He'd pick her up to put her in her wheelchair, but just slam her down into the wheelchair because he was angry. He didn't want to have to do that. And so, it's a horrible, horrible thing. And, as I say these things, I'm looking at your faces and I'm wondering, Did you ever think that those kind of things could happen? Mm-hmm. You know, in just the things of everyday life, of having just to pull your pants up, that somebody could do that. And I don't think that people are aware, and I don't think that people in the disabled community, the women that are suffering these type of things, I think that they very rarely would speak of it. And I think that we need to have more awareness and, you know, put the word out there that it's okay to talk about these things and help people figure out, you know, what are we going to do about it? And how can we get assistance so that with just the simplest daily acts of daily living, people don't have to suffer through.
Thank you. That's actually, so we had a strategy with this, and what Anna was talking about is raising awareness. And it's raising awareness of the service providers, raising awareness of disabled people to start being able to define, you know, what's happening to me. Is it something that, you know, is negative, or do I just have to accept it? And also, I think she brings out, it's part of the complexity of it, is sometimes if it's an intimate partner, when you got married, you didn't sign on for that job, and then it's little by little, it's given to you, and there's no place to talk about it, and then the anger grows, and I've experienced that myself when my daughter was a baby, and they're crying. So I think it's talking about it and like getting past the shame of it. So our strategy was to do a survey in Westchester so that we got some real numbers for Westchester. And then that survey is a way for us to, we got in the Journal News, the results, to start raising awareness. And so with the survey, when we developed the question, we consulted with disabled people. There was a woman who's a quadriplegic who's an attorney who worked very closely with me on this because that's not my field of expertise. So she went over each question. And Liz, we also worked with your group, people in your group, Westchester Partnership for Disabled. They went over the survey questions with us as well as women from the domestic violence world. I think that the big news with the survey is that, it was service providers and law enforcement, is that most people don't collect data. And why is that big news? It's because, you know, what I say is like, you know, think about like our weight. We measure it. What you care about, you measure. So if organizations aren't even measuring how many disabled people are abused, then we're not paying attention to it. So, you know, it's like, let's start measuring. So when the police go on a domestic violence call, I have an example of it's called a domestic violence incident report. It looks like this, that an officer fills out. There is, in type, like about right here, the type is this tiny on this report, where it says notes and it says disability. Now, officers have so much to do, so how are they going to really note that? Not that many law enforcement agencies do collect this data. So one of the things that we're really working for is to train police that know if the person is disabled.
Make a bigger box so they can actually note what kind of disability.
Well, where's the logo?
Huh? I think the international logo. You know, people recognize that.
Right. The thing is working through the police departments and changing this is huge. So what we want to do is we'll start training here in Westchester. Doing the bureaucracy could take years, but we can start training our officers right here. Okay, so the big news is we don't collect, so we're going to really publicize to collect. The other news is like in a year, this is an incidence report. How many were reported? These are real reports. Between men and women, about 500 reports a year. Now, as Anna referred to, it's incredibly underreported. Like some people say, you know, for every one report, there are 8 that go unreported. We know that with elder abuse. We know that with domestic violence. Also, it's 90% of the reports are women. That follows with regular domestic violence. Also, a lot of times people, I think it makes us more comfortable. We think that the abuser is a hired caregiver. It's somebody from outside the family. And no, it's almost 3/4 of the time it is an intimate partner. So it's somebody who, you know, who's giving care, an intimate partner. As far as the types of abuse, you know, physical, emotional, psychological, neglect, they're all just about the same. There wasn't any, you know, one that really came out very strongly. So it's really like anything complex. It's a combination. And the other thing is that is when we ask, you know, what would you like to happen, in about like a third of the cases, it is that they want the abuse to stop, but they want to maintain that relationship. Now, that's the thing, is like, I know when people are almost afraid to say it in domestic violence, the question is why don't they leave? And we're taught, you never ask that question, but I think people do, in the back of their heads, why don't they leave? When we're talking with disabled people, sometimes your ride is your abuser. I mean, they can't leave. So they're in this, you know, my caregiver is my abuser. Or if you imagine being a disabled person, physically disabled, you maybe haven't had a lot of people who have loved you, to, you know, who want to be your boyfriend or girlfriend and marry you. And you get in that relationship and you think it's maybe slim pickings outside it, you might accept a lot more because at least I have somebody. So it makes it really hard to leave. And then there's love involved, like in any relationship. So, or it's a, if it is a, an outside caregiver, who, is somebody else going to be any better at it? Or even just ashamed? Like actually one of the women that I talked to who is a paraplegic, she said that, I mean, this is what really inspired me. She said that, as a woman, my caregiver is taking my clothes off and bathing me, and you can't move your hands, and you have to sit there and have that happen to you. That to me is like a nightmare. So what we're really trying to do is get the word out. Now, what are the barriers? Huge barriers. One is we have 3 domestic violence shelters in the county. 2 of them are handicap accessible. One isn't because it was purchased before we had these laws and is so old, I guess it's impossible to. But that's not the only barrier. Those shelters, they're full almost all the time. So just a couple weeks ago, we had a blind woman who was being abused. I couldn't get her into a shelter. We called all over the place. And then actually through this network, we were able to find a place in a different county. The thing with shelters also, you got a lot of kids in there. And if somebody has a seeing eye dog, can't take dogs in because kids and allergies. So these are all the issues. Now that we're paying attention, we're finding out all of the different roadblocks. What we're doing with Office for Disabled, the first thing we did is we trained each other. And then we're going out and we'll train other service providers. The other thing that I handed out to you, and it has to do, it says coordinated community response. It's your blue sheet. Yeah. What this is, the Family Justice Center, the Office for Women with other partners got a grant to open a Family Justice Center. And that's going to be our opportunity. We're going to have a victim advocate who specializes in working with domestic violence and disabled, so that we'll do PR, we'll do flyers, but that advocate will be trained in that. We also, for the first time, we have money that's in the grant to hire a signer. And the Office for Disabled has told us if we have a walk-in, that they will send somebody over there to sign for us if we can't, because sometimes it's hard to get somebody. So this this coordinated community response, also it's the Family Justice Center. But as you can see, we're really trying to pull in a lot of different organizations because the problem is so complex. No one organization can solve it. And also in these economic times, we have to share our resources. So that's our goal right now, is to start training each other. And right now, as we speak with the Family Justice Center, Anna is working with an office firm and staff member, developing a curriculum to go out and train service providers on how to reach out, and clergy. We're going to have clergy at the Family Justice Center, too. So we'll be going into churches and telling them about this issue, because, like you said, a lot of people think, oh, how could you hit somebody who's in a wheelchair?
And I think that, we think that clergy, so often, you know, women will go to them first and discuss what's going on. And if we make them aware, and if they have disabled women in their congregation, then they can look for signs, but they can also just talk to them about it and, you know, give them a feel. Because again, I think that, you know, so many women will hide and not want to talk about the domestic violence that occurs. And I think that women with disabilities, it's probably even harder for them. So, and then they can also, the clergy can also reach out to the partner, the husband or the intimate partner, just to ask, how are things going? Because, you know, I told you that story about my family member, and once I became aware of it, at first I was really angry, and I, you know, I wanted to deck this guy. But then, I did. But then I was able to remove myself from my emotional feeling and sit down and talk to him. And I saw his frustration, and as I saw his frustration and the more we talked about it, I could see his anger building up. And like Annette said, you know, it, I guess in those vows we say better or worse, sickness and health, but no one really imagines, you know, a lifelong kind of thing. You know, even myself, when I said those vows, I was thinking, well, when our life is ready to come to the end, then I will be there with him, and I will be at the hospital every day and in those final days. But the idea that, you know, someone is 35 years old and has become disabled, and, you know, now we got another 40 years, that's, you know, that's not what you
signed up for,
and that's exactly the words that this man said to me. I didn't sign up for this. This is not what I felt my retirement was going to be. And then he was able to, because I gave him an opportunity to actually come out and say, I can't do this. Please, I can't do this any longer. And this all just came about in the past few months, and since then, we brought some people in to help out in the home, and life has changed dramatically for both him and for my cousin. So, you know, speaking about it, not being afraid to talk, because when, you know, when she first told me, she said, don't you say anything to him about it, and because she was ashamed, but also because she was afraid. So we just got to get it out there, I think.
Yeah, and as the reporter, if I may, through the chair, there's a blame game going on if this person loses that loved one. And I hope that it's within the plan of how you bring it together. And I guess case management really comes into the picture from the different, when you say coordinated community response, there needs to be some coordination, because it's something that we're using more now in case management is respite, because these caregivers need respite. So,
exactly. And to help people find the different resources that are out there. I mean, just like our office, you know, we then through the Department of Transportation and Office for the Disabled, we have paratransit. A lot of people aren't aware of paratransit. And, you know, for this, I mean, I can keep using this example that she uses a wheelchair, but to get to doctor's appointments and things like that, they were putting her into the vehicle, and it was a Jeep, so having to get her up in it. They had to fold up that wheelchair and keep picking it up, and mm-hmm. You know what, I took on that responsibility for quite a while, and it's not a big deal, but when you have to get them out of the house, get them into the Jeep, fold up the wheelchair, put it into the back of it, get to your first stop, take out the wheelchair, get her out of it, back and forth. At the end of a, you know, morning of going to the doctor and maybe going to the drugstore and stopping at the supermarket, I'm freaking exhausted. I it's like, oh my God. Yeah, but
you're the victim now. Yeah.
But Anna, there are some that you will not change. I have a number of my district. I continually encourage them to use paratransit, the different events, and they just say thank you, but no thank you. It's my struggle. And I can't for the love of me understand why, because then the comments come out afterward. Oh, I wish this, like you say. But it's the choice they make, and, you know, God bless them for making that choice. But we do. I know my colleagues and I continually profess the good things that paratransit does, and when people don't choose to use it, regardless of a fee or not, we can't be their judge.
No, but we can.
Just through the chair, please, from now on, don't, because May had a hand up before.
Vito, okay. I apologize.
It's okay.
Guys, take your scolding.
I just returned from the National Conference on Aging this past week, and great speakers were Gail Sheehan doing the whole thing on caregiving. Her new book is coming out, and she has agreed to come to Westchester to talk about and to conduct a caregiver symposium. We talk about formal services, and we all know that our resources are shrinking. Well, the most rewarding part of this trip was spending 2 days with this woman in a wheelchair. Now, a year ago when I saw her, she was healthy and wholesome, and she has trained over 1,500 social workers. And then she was hit by a truck this past summer.
Oh.
5 months in the hospital, 7 operations. I was a little bit shocked. I saw that she was there, and I used to communicate by computer with her husband while he was going through this with her in the hospital. It happened in Pennsylvania, and it was a while before they could get her back to New York. But the most important thing to him was to have a little bit of time out. Mm-hmm. So I spent 2 days with her. She can't hold a cup. She sat next to me at all the meetings, at all of her meals. We went to the restroom together. He was so supportive throughout all of this for months, emailing back and forth and sending words of encouragement. But I didn't see him smile one time. And I knew that he was supportive throughout all of this. But it has worn him down. A year of this has worn him down. And he got her to Chicago. She was on that panel with Gail Sheehy, and she sits on the board with me. But he was just worn down. He was so glad to know that he could leave the room and somebody was sitting next to her to give her water. Somebody was sitting next to her to feed her, to take her to the restroom. I think we talk about formal services, respite and paratransit, and those services are shrinking. But there's nothing like somebody just extending a helping hand.
Yep.
That's right. When I saw them on the plane coming back, he thanked me. He says, this is the first break I've had for a year. Wow. Just to have somebody just step in. I wasn't a formal caregiver. Mm-hmm. I wasn't being paid. Mm-hmm. But this man was burnt out.
Yeah.
And so I think that encouraging houses of worship to step in and have someone to buddy up and be a friend to people who are struggling 24 hours a day, to people with wheelchairs who can't feed themselves, who can't lift a cup, who can't drink water. Mm-hmm. We've got to encourage people to just extend their hand. The formal services are shrinking. The money is not going to come back. It's going to have to be people talking to people that's going to make the difference.
I just wanted to respond because I think May brings up a really important point, because with domestic violence, in the past, it's always that, the perpetrator is, throw him in jail, he is the villain. I think that there is a little bit, there are two sides of the equation with this that we do have to be aware of, is that caregiver, think of the trauma that somebody feels when you've gotten worn down and maybe you do a little spank or something like that. People who have raised young children might have experienced that themselves. So I think that that's another part of this complexity, is that we need, it's preventive, by paying attention to that caregiver. How do we give him or her some respite care so that they can recharge their bodies and keep doing that really hard job that they're doing?
So we're reaching out to the houses of worship now to sort of start satellite adult daycare hourly programs for the disabled, just to give that caregiver a couple of mornings out, 2 or 3 hours. To go grocery shop, do whatever they want to do. But they have become prisoners.
Yes.
And if you want to help the disabled, you've got to do something for the caregivers.
Anybody else have any questions before we...
And you personalized your statement. I it takes a community to raise a child, is an old saying, and there's a lot of contradiction to it. But really, we are the community. I'm going to share with you something that we thought was going to be dramatic in my family with the retirement of my mom, whom, to her credit, managed to get to age 66 and continue to work. But the doctor was telling her no to. She finally retired, and I mentioned at the last meeting that she got some AARP or whatever it was, census, false reporting and so on and so forth. So here we are. I am the one closest in the family, and thinking that me and my family have to pitch in for my mom to adjust. And the first couple of months, it was, you know, we knew my mom could be relentless. We had the same temper, so you can imagine mm-hmm. the two of us there. And I'm thinking with my wife, how are we going to do to keep her entertained and so on and so forth. I introduce her to all of what I know to this committee. So she signs up for the YW in Yonkers. And reluctantly, she doesn't even want to go play bingo with the neighbors or anything like that. We did a trip last month. Finally, she signs up. She's going to this place. We're looking for my mom. She can't be found anymore. All of a sudden, she has friends, and she's going to some company in Westchester this past weekend. Now my kids are missing her more and more than anything else. And I'm bringing this up because if you share whatever you have, because as disabled as you may be, there may be something that this person can offer, mm-hmm. you know, and if even if it is dialogue, you know. And then in turn you get somebody else to really admire this person and like you did for this person for 2 days, and once the cooperation in the community happens, everybody has assets. And if we concentrate on that, and I think that should be the case manager that I'm talking about, everybody pitches in and everybody gets a respite. And it's really good, because what I thought would be a headache, now I'm missing my mom. You know,
so good just for her.
Exactly. Very good for her. Yeah, she got away from me.
I know.
Okay. Is that...
Yes, unless there are any questions.
Okay, well, I want to thank you. I think you're doing a heck of a job. For lots and lots and lots of people, I hope the word gets around. And like you say, with the police and with the, you know, houses of worship and everything else, that making people more aware so that they, you know, might not have known there's abuse. It's picked up. But anyway, we thank you very much, and we hope you most success and good results.
Thank you.
May?
Yeah, we started a caregiving coaching program with Fordham, and we graduated 25 coaches this past January, and we started a new class. So you might want to, some of these families you run into, you might want to have a coach to work with the caregiver and to help them navigate this maze of what's out there. But most important, the sign is that it's somebody they can just charge. Sure. And they can pick up the phone and they can just call.
Yeah, because the other people are waiting.
Okay, the caregiving coaching program.
All right, Jose,
and make sure that this coordinated community response has sort of check and balances type of a thing that we can make sure is working, because it sounds good in paper and you see all these agencies. But are we really reacting? And if they're not, somebody should be watching and making sure that it works, because in this committee we hear all the good stuff that's happening and all the good intentions, but then without any follow-up, it just ends up being a nice...
This will be at the Family Justice Center, which is at the courthouse. There'll be a director of the Family Justice Center who has been hired. He starts March 26th, this Friday. And the Justice Center, it's in the DA's office, they're painting as we speak. So there, it's a formal structure, and in the office room, and we're oversighting it. So
and at some point, report back to us, because at the end of the day, we are partners in this, and we represent all of the county individually, and we want to know and promote.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to ask whether 211 has been utilized at all as a resource for getting any of this information out in terms of places that people can call. Is that true? Mm-hmm.
211, yes.
That is 211. What we do with senior programs, the Crime Busters program, which is, you know, but 211 was the first number that we always set to call.
And they have information now of where people can go to get support.
I can tell you the person, because he is officially March 26th, the director of the Family Justice Center, was in charge of 211 at United Way. So. Ken Donato.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
He's coming over.
That's terrific. He's going to be the director of the Family Justice Center.
Oh, what a good
hire.
Yes. I mean, I'm sorry, Fiona.
Yes, I'm, yeah. But he is, because he's law enforcement.
Yes.
And is very
involved. Well, he used to be my police lieutenant.
Yeah. He's cool.
Wow.
So probably in the not too distant future, we can come back and actually talk all about the
results.
Justice Center.
Right.
Oh, nice.
And how it's
terrific.
Going.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. And now we have... Top Chef Meals will present an overview of gourmet, affordable, customized meals that can be delivered throughout Westchester County. Okay.
Do we get our place settings now?
Maybe. We'll ask them. Okay.
Excuse me, you got samples.
Could you ask
them? It's not a way to diet to ignore good foods. I'm going to stay here. I'm going to sit through the whole thing.
Huh?
I'll just have
listen, to I just have to make a quick phone call. I'll be right back in.
They may give me sugar.
Sure.
I wanted May to see the food.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
What?
Paul.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh,
Paul Karen.
Yeah.
Bill Kuttner.
Oh.
And Heather Hendrickson. Step up. Thank you. Here you go.
Nursing home and died that night. Go all the way through.
Yeah.
Well, I just.
Where was this? Okay.
And it is. It's
dead by fall.
Oh God. Well, that's all.
Oh yeah. You have a heart thing. You ever got a heart problem?
You want to sit up there?
Broken heart. There is
something. Well, that's exactly what we decided to do.
Okay.
Dying of a broken heart is less costly.
No, but they really do. I just read an article about it. I mean,
everybody, are you going to speak?
Yes.
Paul.
Okay, I got a hold of that.
No, my better friend.
Okay. Paul, how did you get that off?
No, no, that's good.
She was 78, he was 85. But he was gone.
No, you'll be fine, Bill.
Okay. The one I memorialized last night, her husband. Yeah, I can give them 6 months. I'm just gonna, they were so close.
Is he going to speak or what is he doing? Okay. Yes, but he wants to get started, so everybody, Paul.
Kieran. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for having us here today. I really appreciate it. I'd like to start by telling you a personal story. It's about an 80-year-old gentleman who has heart disease, rheumatic fever, diabetes, and struggling to try to figure out how he can feed himself in the dwindling economy, dwindling resources that he has to support himself. And, you know, he's caught between the options of going to the supermarket and buying the very high-sodium frozen meals that are often available in the supermarket. And his doctor absolutely says, no, you can't be eating that kind of sodium. It's just absolutely not, I mean, not good for you, especially somebody with rheumatic fever as a child. And on the other hand, having restaurant fare delivered to his house, which is by all means large portions, usually much more than he needs to eat, and very expensive, frankly, in, you know, what he can afford. This person, who incidentally is my father, talk to me about these troubles and similar troubles of many people that he knows, and just what could be done in order to help the senior population and the disabled population as well, speaking of prior discussions, on how to help him be able to feed himself and the caregivers and support and everything else that he needs. And it was from that experience that he came up with the idea of Top Chef Meals. And it's an outgrowth of my company's decision, not decision, my company's work as corporate catering, which is what we've been doing for many, many years, and some high volume work that we've done to deliver numerous meals in a large volume setting. What I did was I fused and took the work of my chefs and my cooks that work for me and said, listen, I can take those same individuals and in the hours that they are not working on corporate catering, which usually finishes around noon because most corporate catering occurs during lunch, and put them to work in the evening hours to prepare these meals for seniors. And so it's almost like I have this pool of chef talent that's free in order to create these meals. And it really was an opportunity to give back to the community for myself. You know, it's rare in this world that we get an opportunity in our work to really do something to make a meaningful difference to people's lives. And this was very, very important to me, especially in how I saw it with my father and what we could do. And so out of that was born this whole concept of Top Chef Meals. And basically what I did is I started with the concept that really to give people a choice in what they wanted to eat. More than anything else, you know, my dad would walk in the supermarket and say, you know, Paul, I might like the chicken, but I don't have any choice of what comes on the side of it. I'm going to have to eat. If I'm allergic to peppers and there's peppers in that chicken, I'm stuck. There's nothing for me to eat whatsoever. And so I really came up with, you know, the concept of giving the senior an opportunity to choose exactly what they wanted. What they wanted for their side dishes, what they wanted for the entree, and if there's anything that from a diabetic, a low sodium, a, you know, allergy standpoint, they could call us and tell us and say, no, I can't eat that. Please change it so that I can eat the meal and get the nutrition that I need. It was from that and my staff who I sent out to start to go around, Bill and Heather are here with me, go around and start to try to market this opportunity to various senior centers, they've been to numerous senior housing, I can't tell you how many different places they've been to talk to about the concept and about what we do and get feedback into the meals and everything that we did, that we came up with an idea of how we think that we can save the county a tremendous amount of money. And so from that, we're here to speak to you today about how we think that there's an initiative that could be done for Meals on Wheels and their congregate meals that could save the county a tremendous amount of money.
Wow.
First and foremost, we have to provide seniors, nutritionally balanced meals. And when I say nutritionally balanced, I mean meeting that one-third minimum, meeting that one-third RDA, because for many of these seniors, they only get that one meal. You know, the reality is many of them are not going to be able to feed themselves and have the income and everything else to get the nutrition that they need, and our best opportunity is this one shot that we have with them. The plan is to reduce the overall costs, and when I say reduce overall costs, I mean costs of both the labor to create and prepare the meals, as well as the food itself that we're purchasing to make the meals. What can we do with those benefits, with that savings that we're talking about generating? You can continue service when budgets are reduced, and I have no idea what's currently happening in the budgets, but I know you can't miss the news. You really know what's coming. You can expand the service to the currently unserved seniors and the disabled population of Westchester if you choose to use the money that way, or fund any other associated programs that you want to do. But the biggest thing is increase senior participation. Okay, by giving seniors a choice of either a hot or a frozen meal so that they can eat the meal at their choosing, or a choice of several different entrees each day, we can encourage greater congregate meal participation. And that's really what we need. We need the seniors to come to the senior centers and get that socialization that they need to get and meet and work at, you know, have socialize with other people and not feel trapped in their homes if at all possible. So our program plan calls for providing nutritionally balanced meals to all of the Westchester sites. And when I say all, I'm saying there's an economy of scale that can be gained. Okay? The meals would be prepared by professional chefs and cooks. We would provide 10 different meals per week. So there's definitely a huge choice that you could do. Okay? Meals would be hermetically sealed in a tray such as this. Advantage of the tray is it's a paperboard, it's completely biodegradable. Just throw it in the garbage and it's going to compost just like with anything else. It's ovenable. You can stick this in the oven up to 400 degrees, and also you can microwave it. And we've done testing on it that we've done it every different way possible. We even tried toaster oven, which actually can make work even in the toaster oven, which is not easy to do. You have to cover the top with some aluminum foil so you don't burn the top of the paper. But it even works in the toaster oven.
Wow.
We would deliver the meals to all of the existing sites via refrigerated truck. And we would offer to provide and maintain all the freezers and all the ovens needed at all the congregate meal sites to serve the meals. And we're saying to you that we could do this for $2.87 a meal delivered to you, to the county. And I say or less because I really don't have a total, I have no idea what the total population is that's being served by the congregate meals and Meals on Wheels. That assumes a worst case scenario. That's the highest it would be that we could do it for. That's assuming 500 participants, and I'm sure that there's a lot more than 500 participants. Congregate meals participants would be offered several different choices, okay? It either could be served buffet style, or it could be served in the individual trays, either way. Because I know that some of the congregate sites like to have that family-style atmosphere of serving that way, and we could also certainly accommodate that as well. There's a benefit, though, to be gained to using the trays themselves, because by using the trays, there's less waste. There's less leftovers and less waste.
And there's no kitchen help to clean.
And there's no kitchen that has to be cleaned. So that's true. Each site would still, from the delivered meals perspective, each site would do exactly what they're doing right now. Deliver the meals with their support of all the volunteers. And we would not seek to change any of that whatsoever. What we're really talking about here is the production of the food only. It's not how the meals are delivered, not any of the socialization that goes on, none of that. We're just talking about food production. So what are the current program challenges? Well, from my staff going out and talking to so many of the different seniors throughout, and we've been to every corner of the county talking to seniors and getting feedback. And what we hear from them is we're hearing some of what they feedback we're getting from them about what they feel about the congregate meals and about the Meals on Wheels. We hear that from the volunteers that they're very concerned that many of the meals spill in their car or that their car smells from the food.
I had that.
Just like when you pick up pizza.
Well, but it's worse.
But the pizza smell eventually goes away.
Yeah,
well, one of the advantages of the system we're talking about, by having the meals in hermetically sealed containers, that would totally eliminate that. You'd have absolutely no spillage and no smells in the car whatsoever. Often volunteers tell us that their schedule is dictated by the kitchen. If the kitchen doesn't have the food ready when they're trying to have it ready, mm-hmm. that they can't get out that's on the road and go make the meal deliveries. Mm-hmm. And the system we're talking about would eliminate that issue as well. Because the food will be already delivered and already on site at each one of the reheating, the congregate sites and the distribution points. From the clients, we hear that nothing to eat if they don't like that day's meal, or if they don't like a component, that they just aren't going to eat it. And, they often don't know, they know what the menu is, certainly. Many of them know what the menu is. As a matter of fact, many of them are keen whether or not to come to the congregate sites or not based on the menus. But without a choice, they feel often sort of trapped. Hey, I don't have anything to eat today. And we'd really like to see if there's a way to eliminate that so that nobody goes hungry. They also feel like they have no choice of what time to eat. And by at least asking the client, you know, would you like today to get a hot meal or would you like today to get a frozen meal? If you get a frozen meal, then you can choose what time do you want to reheat it. It's a big benefit. You have some challenges, obviously, in terms of holidays, inclement weather, snowstorms, everything else in terms of seniors not getting food. And those are things that this kind of a system would help eliminate. If you know there's a snowstorm coming the next day, deliver in a frozen meal on the day before, and then they will have food. Okay.
That's provided somebody in the house can get it prepared for them. Sometimes
that's
true.
So
we do have an accounting. Okay, that's a great point. I like it.
Thank you.
Just wanted to point that out.
So what are your costs? I really don't know exactly what your costs are. You know, it's not that I'm going to presuppose what your costs. All I know is that from research, the national cost average for delivering meals on wheels, and I'm talking both the labor to prepare the meal and the food itself, is in that range. Okay? That makes sense from a logic standpoint because numerous sites producing the food at every individual site has to have staff to cook and backup staff in case that staff is out to prepare the food in each and every case. So just simple math, if you have three employees that are at $10 an hour, and I have no idea what you guys are paying the staff at these different sites, I would guess to say it's probably something more than that, preparing an average of like 120 meals, that's $2 per meal just in staff costs. Additionally, if you have an individual site and it's each of your individual sites are preparing food and purchasing food, you don't have that economy of scale that you can do when you purchase the food for the entire and one place to drop off that food. Vendors will typically discount based on the drop size and how much volume you buy. As you make smaller volume purchases for each one of the individual sites, it's inherently more expensive because the raw product and the amount of raw product that you have to utilize and then have left over to create the number of meals you need is not spread among a lot of people, it's spread among a small group of people. And it's typical vendors to charge government agencies with low volumes rates of the 20 to 40% range. Okay, and we're under two digits in what they charge us. Okay, it's a big difference in the procurement costs when you have a large volume operation. There's also an additional opportunity or additional concern that as individual sites prepare food, there's definitely a greater waste and spoilage potential. You know, if you prepare meals for 100 people and because of rain or whatever, 50 people show up, you have 50 meals that are not going to be served, and you have to figure out how to use them or how to save them or how to rework them. I'm not sure what you're doing right now, but it's virtually impossible to save that food, at least all of them. If you take that spoilage factor and you put it across your entire spectrum of people, you're going to save a tremendous amount of money. So what are some of the risk factors that we see in the current delivery system and current system is this that meals are delivered in, that are delivered in insulated carriers really have the potential to not meet Board of Health temperature requirements. No matter what, if you take a meal and it's a small portion meal, and this is going to be true, by the way, even if in our system as well. If you take a meal and you heat it to 160 degrees and you stick it in a thermal carrier and you stick, the person's going to go make five deliveries. Okay, that last delivery is unlikely to be above that 140 degrees. It's just you don't have enough mass of food to stay warm. It's just very difficult to do.
When you're the last house on the pizza delivery truck.
Additionally, delivered hot meals that sit on a counter or whatever have potential for bacteria growth, and especially for those people who say, well, you know, you deliver the meal and you say, well, I don't want to eat now, and the meal just sits there for who knows how long before they actually choose to eat it. If they choose instead to get a frozen meal that they could heat later, you wouldn't have that issue. Aluminum containers, unlike the one that we're using, that are being used in many of the sites currently, have sharp edges. And, you know, many seniors are not very good at handling those sharp edges. I myself have cut myself plenty of times on those sharp edges on some of the aluminum containers.
Yes, Sally.
And lastly, reheating meals in ovens, regular ovens, is inherently dangerous for people who have limited faculties, and a microwave would probably be a better source, a way for them to heat. So who are we? We're located in Elmsford. I brought a couple of my staff. I'd like to introduce them at this time. Heather, if you'd please get up. Heather is my director of business development, and Bill is my director of procurement. He does all the procuring for the company.
Excuse me, I have a meeting.
I'd like to entertain any questions as I summarize that, you know, combining your food production, I'm talking just the production aspect of it, to a single source will greatly reduce your costs. If you choose to do it with me or you choose to do it with somebody else, you're going to save money no matter what, okay? You reduce duplication of staff, you can use that. You have an opportunity now to use that staff in other areas where they might benefit you, okay? You leverage your purchasing power, you create a single site for waste, and we offer a controlled manufacturing process where we have experienced procurement professionals who know how to procure, safely produce the food, and deliver the food to your sites. Okay.
You want a question?
Lastly, we have the facilities, management, and experience. Yes.
Oh, Bernice, when you get
okay.
Bernice.
Go ahead, Bill.
Okay. Do you have contracts with established senior centers at this point?
We don't have any established. We just started this concept a few months ago. And we're actually in negotiations with one right now, down in Harlem, actually. Okay. And we're talking to others as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we wanted to really pitch this. Instead of going to individual senior centers in the county, again, we feel this is a much better way for the county. And as a resident, you know, who was born and grew up here, you know, I really feel it's important for the whole county.
I was watching Ms. Carpenter's face as it went along here, and just... We were telepathically communicating about my senior site in Austin, and saying to ourselves, "Wow, this could solve a couple of problems." I'm channeling myself, not Meg.
Are you sure?
No, you never know because May is usually about three steps ahead of me.
Yes.
The maintenance of the kitchen and the cost of keeping that up. Not only staffing it, but just the space, the sanitation, the inspections, these things bedevil us. It's a very difficult place. It's an interior space. It doesn't vent well. It's all sorts of problems. This alone is worth probably 50 cents a meal. And to be able to take that cost out of it is a terrific thing. I'm going to, and in fact, I'd like to get a couple more of these if
yeah,
I might,
too.
To, shall we say, take home.
Okay. Well,
thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Jose.
I always had something to say by now.
Yes.
but I'm going to play devil's advocate.
Certainly.
All right, because your presentation is awesome. This is really exciting to all of us that are familiar with meals, safety, health. To me, honestly, it sounds too good to be and all I can say is I am hopeful that, as Mr. Burton is saying, that we take advantage of this because it's going to be a lot of fun. Matter of fact, we can begin to neglect a lot of the kitchens that a lot of institutions manage to invest in. But if we're going to do this, what I would hate to see, and I will hold your feet to the fire.
Absolutely.
Is this becoming a monopoly when you finally really invest on the staff and everything else, and this 2.85 estimate that you give us begins to go up, and then you're going to hear...
I'm telling you here that the estimate is going to go down, not up. And I know this to be fact because we do this for other clients for under that price.
Okay. And I don't want to play the Avenatti rule here, I told you so, but that's my only concern, that this is this sounds unbelievable.
You know, I would be happy to have county employees at my facility.
Before Jeannie speaks to you, I just want to say that Kathy Marin, I'm from Yonkers, okay? I work in the nutrition sites there, okay? We need them, like you said, to get people. I get people very involved, okay, day and night, and all kinds of programs, mentally, physically, keeping them alive and all. We use the hospital, okay, for our food where we are. And you know, it's okay, you know, as far as it's got a lot to be desired, but what I wouldn't want to take the interaction and the action, and I try very hard. My boss over here, Kathy Moran, will tell you that we go around speaking to all the sites that you're talking about in Yonkers, talking about the different things that we have, the food and everything else. They have parties on every holiday, everything, and we use the food all the time. But we also have their home-delivered meals. The meals are brought first to the place, then brought to home-delivered. And the people that come there, some of them, a lot of men, take home, they eat a meal there, and they take home a meal because they don't want to cook.
Right.
Okay. So it's a lot. It's a lot of things that, you know, are taken into consideration. But I really feel most of these senior places are homes away from home. It keeps them really mentally and physically. If it could work in that concept, and it could work in with home-delivered meals, you know, it's up to the commissioner who's sitting right opposite May Carpenter. But Jeannie has been working in nutrition since I started. How many years?
And Darcy.
Okay, and Darcy. I'm Jeannie PC. I was thinking of. Okay, go ahead, Ann.
And just before, I mean, it's just something that you didn't explain, or I don't know what flash frozen means.
Flash frozen is a technique where you rapidly cool a product. The danger zone for food is somewhere between 40 and 140 degrees. So when you cook a product, let's say to over 180 degrees, or at least over 160 degrees, depending on the type of product that you have, once it cools to 140, it's critical that you bring it down to below that 40 degrees as rapidly as possible. And this is what the Board of Health talks about frequently. Mm-hmm. What we do is we have special freezers, which are called blast freezers,
if you want to pick it,
which drop the food temperature in under 90 minutes.
Feel free to get some more
from that 140 to below 40 degrees.
I'm not.
That's
wow. Okay, first Ann.
I know it seems like a very worthy program, but at this time,
it
meeting the guidelines. First of all, I wanted to be clear to the legislators that this program, although the county oversees it, it is funded through the state and federal government.
Right. Yes,
it's and we have specific guidelines for the meal program to meet the one-third of the RDA.
Yes, indeed.
In the supply compensation, that you meet the one-third of the RDA.
Well, the meal we're talking about is not just that.
I know. Because on your website, you talked about choice and allow the senior to select the meal. Well, then there's no guarantee to meet the one-third of the RDA. I do not get funded for this program unless we meet one-third of the RDA. And in terms of our menus, we do a two-month cycle menu, an eight-week cycle menu, which presents a lot of variety, contrary to what you had presented. We do not repeat the same meal within the time. You know, although the kitchen, if you're just looking at food production,
depends on who you use as your provider.
Food production is very clear.
Right.
Maybe
East Chester
so
doesn't
large,
cook. Greenberg.
Yeah, maybe you could beat the cost, although my cost for we're on a unit cost base for the county. We're doing $2.75 for a home-delivered meal in Greenberg. So we're still below your $2.87. So the state and federal program, in terms of the guidelines,
I've got to go.
I don't
go
see
ahead.
The program
I've got
meeting
some things to put together
the guidelines
before
the way it is presented. Even if you change the menu, I have a problem with the frozen meal aspect. I mean, although it would save money on a week's basis, maybe, and I'm even questioning that because I don't, right now with the entrees that you're passing around, the meal presentation, it's an entree and two sides. We also provide the meal, the bread, the margarine, and the dessert.
Right.
For that cost, I did not see that on your website, so I think there's a lot of different, maybe aspects of the meal that are missing. So for that same price, I'm providing those other components, the fruit. I have to meet, two vegetables a day and that, and you know, it's either presented in the dessert or the entree.
Let me back up. Let me just address that. Okay, I'm not talking about the meals that we're doing on Top Chefs being what I'm talking about. Okay, you're making a little bit of a stretch in from the meal, what I'm offering on a website that we're delivering, to what I'm talking about in this program. What I'm talking about in this program is where we're going to include the milk, the meal, the juice, the bread, the fruit, the dessert. I'm talking about all those components for that $2.87. Okay?
But we're offering a certain number? 500?
That's that $2.87 is based on 500.
Delivered. Delivered to where?
Whatever sites you tell us to deliver.
Oh, in bulk.
In bulk.
Okay. So we still need staff.
I just want to
point that out.
We still need staff at the programs to deliver to maintain the food. I think the volunteers are important to go to the sites and meet with the staff. There's not as much savings
as you're presenting, is my point.
Excuse me, Paul. You're talking about volunteers helping. They pay people. They have site managers that have to sit there, check out who comes in, and fill out all the papers, you know, that are there. They have people behind the counter, okay, like you say, dishing out, okay. If you bring it in, it's already, you know, cooked. But they don't have volunteers. They do pay staff.
Right. I'm talking about
some of the programs do have volunteers.
I'm talking about the volunteers. I'm talking about the drivers who go to deliver the meals.
Meals on Wheels.
Right.
Like Meals on Wheels. That's the volunteers that I'm talking about. Okay. I'm saying you would save the staff who's cooking the meals. So although your price might be that, you're not including the cost of that staff, which you'd now be able to use that staff in other areas.
Go ahead, Meg.
What is the delivery charge?
For what?
For this. I noticed that here it says...
You mean when we're doing an individual home delivery?
Your first order is free of our delivery charge. Is there a base delivery charge? And it does it vary?
I think there's a little confusion between what we're talking about up here and our brochure that is an individual deliver to a home offer that we do.
Okay. Now, I would like the answer to that one.
To that one, we charge $15 to deliver the meals for as large as the order is, until you get over $150 and the delivery's free.
Per day.
Go ahead, May.
We subcontract the nutrition programs to municipalities, and they all come under procurement policies, which means they ask people to submit bids if they're not doing direct preparation. Now, we have some kitchens that are cooking directly and also serving other communities. But even those kitchens that are cooking are having to be competitive with other people bidding for that business at those other nutrition sites. I certainly can see the economy of scale there. I can certainly see some uniformity in terms of standards. Of course, whatever you propose would have to meet the specifications, bid specifications that are set out by federal and state standards in the health department. But there certainly is an economy of scale there. Back in 1979, Westchester County had the highest unit cost in the nation, practically, for its nutrition programs. And we decided to go on site and start cooking some of our own meals. And we were able to cut the cost significantly by cooking our own meals in some kitchens, setting up seven kitchens that cooked for those seven sites, as well as cooking for other neighboring sites. But I think someone mentioned, I think Jose mentioned that the prices go up, and that's why you have the bid process. To stay competitive. So I certainly would say that when the municipalities go out to get bids under their procurement policies, that you should submit a bid and make sure you are aware of what the federal and state specifications are in order to be in compliance. Because, as I said before, there's some economies of scale in terms of bulk purchasing, in terms of bulk cooking. You can't deny it. You just can't deny it. We started serving four and five times more meals for the same price when we started doing that type of regionalization. That was just regionalization. Now, some communities did not participate in the regional program. They went out, and you have FLIC here in Westchester that serves a lot of the colleges and hospitals. So they did. They serve some of our communities. But I certainly think that you should put your hat in the ring in terms of...
We certainly would, but I guess we'll say, regardless of whether you choose us or not, that's not really my issue.
The point is that we don't choose. The individual municipalities choose.
That's how I was trying to get
that. But I also have to approve through the state, because the state... requires me to inspect your facility also. I know I'll approve the contract between the municipality and the
For instance, the town of Greenberg, for instance, prepares Meals on Wheels for White Plains and East Chester.
That's right. That's a regional kitchen.
It's a regional kitchen. Right.
And if I could address your one comment about the menu. You're absolutely correct. You have a menu cycle that creates a lot of variety for the seniors. There's no denying what you do. Thought process is that if there is a senior who does not like sauerbraten or does not like pot roast or cannot eat a fish of that particular day, this will give them the opportunity to, we know that they're going to hopefully eat. And that's the difference. And what also is a difference is the fact that on a day like when we have a Monday snowstorm or a president's holiday, we don't know if that senior is eating. If that senior doesn't have anything left over that weekend, and they have a frozen meal in their freezer, we know at least that they're getting proper nutrition.
Well, we address that.
Yeah, we address that.
Well, we give them lots of sandwiches.
But my point about the one-third is that if a senior always has a choice on a daily basis, there is no guarantee for the one-third. Your one-third RDA cannot be guaranteed because it's dependent on the senior's choice.
And
depending on what they choose.
Just a minute. In other words, I'm there. Let's say they have Seafood Newburgh, okay? A lot of people are allergic. They can't eat it. That's what you have that day. But they have the opportunity to know what the menu is and order the cold meal, which might be a turkey sandwich, right? So they do have a choice.
And many of the Kiner programs are offering a choice at lunch. The hot meal, there's a cold sandwich. Greenberg Kitchen, for instance, is providing that for some of the, a lot of the different caterers are doing that, and some of the other regional kitchens are addressing that also.
Sure.
With the county purchasing department, I do food contracts, so we're involved in bulk purchasing also.
Government ops.
What I was just talking about for that first question, because we're saying you would set the menu.
Okay, excuse me, I'm on Mike Kaplowitz's committee, which is government ops. We ran over our time, and I don't like when people do that to me, so I don't want to do it to them. And I just want to tell you that we appreciate you coming. We like to learn. We like to know new ideas and everything else there. I'm very pleased, and so are the county legislators who came in to see it, okay?
Thank you.
And if anybody has any questions, they have your brochure.
And we can give these out.
Yes,
of course. Thank you.
Okay, before I adjourn, the next meeting next week on Tuesday, if anybody wants to come, it's youth, okay? It's March 30th, and it's Marlene Furtick, and it's 10:30. 10:30, it will be over before 11:30. And the next one, April 20th, our third, is Greg Olson. We should know exactly what's happening at the state at that point with the Medicare.
Okay. I will not be here next Tuesday, I'm sorry.
That's for education.
Yeah, okay.
Move to adjourn?
Second.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I did it and I didn't realize it.